Carrying My Cross. The ninth talk in a series entitled The Mind of Christ was presented by Ron Julian on March 6, 2011 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are continuing in our series called The Mind of Christ. We're exploring a number of important themes in the teaching of Jesus. Our goal is to be, basically, to be better disciples, better students of our teacher and master. There is one issue, I think, that runs throughout everything that Jesus taught. That issue is our willingness to accept the truth and live by it. The root of the human problem is our stubborn hearts. This is what he's saying. We have this problem inside, and that's the whole problem. Jesus is constantly telling us in one way or another that we will never find true life unless we stop lying to ourselves. We will never find life unless we abandon our stubbornness and accept the truth, submit to the truth. So he confronts us with that basic issue in a variety of ways in his teaching. Will we admit that Jesus has come to bring the mercy and blessing of God? Will we admit that we ourselves are evil people who need God's mercy? Will we see other people as equal to ourselves, made in God's image and in need of mercy just as we are? Will we honor our fellow believers as followers of the same Christ that we follow? We will not do these things perfectly, but if we stubbornly refuse to let these truths affect our lives, then we will never find life. And I would argue that basically there isn't anything in Jesus' teaching that ultimately doesn't come back to asking us to accept the truth about the big questions. So today we're going to look at another way that Jesus confronts us with the truth, another aspect of life where we have to decide how we're going to respond based on what we believe and whether we have acknowledged and embraced the truth about God and ourselves. So to introduce the theme for today, I want to start with a parable. This is one of Jesus' most important parables, one of his kingdom parables, and this is found in Matthew 13. Right at the beginning, we'll start at the beginning of Matthew 13. On that day, Jesus went out of the house and was sitting by the sea, and great multitudes gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat down, and the whole multitude was standing on the beach. And he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, "Behold, the sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and ate them up. And others fell upon the rocky places, where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up, because they had no depth of soil. But when the sun had risen, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And others fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. And others fell on the good soil and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. He who has ears, let him hear." Now, as it happens, and as you probably know, Jesus rarely explains his parables. He often doesn't even tell you what he's talking about. He just tells a story, and you're left to figure out what is that story about, and what does it have to do with anything. In this case, however, we have his explanation of the parable. He explains this privately to his disciples, and we see that starting in verse 18. "Hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is the one on whom seed was sown beside the road. And the one on whom seed was sown on the rocky places, this is the man who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary. And when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he falls away. And the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. And the one on whom seed was sown on the good soil, this is the man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. Okay, so we can see the general idea, I think is fairly easy to see in the story. Jesus is talking about different responses to his message. He calls his message here the word of the kingdom. For simplicity's sake, I'm just going to refer to it as the gospel. I think that's a fair characterization. He's comparing the way people, different sorts of people, respond to the gospel to the way different kinds of soil react when the seed falls on them. So when Jesus preaches his gospel, he is like one who scatters seed so that the crops will grow. He's looking for a result. Whether or not the sower gets a crop depends on the kind of soil that the seed falls on. And there are three different kinds of soil that will fail to produce the crop that the sower is looking for. Likewise, whether the gospel has its intended result depends on the heart of the person who hears the message, and there are three different ways that a heart can respond wrongly to the gospel. Now, today, I'm looking at this parable because there's one of these four soils that I want to talk about that will introduce our theme for today. The soil that we're concerned with today is the second one, the rocky soil. So in this story, when you plant a crop, you want a rich, soft loam that the roots can grow into deeply. This gives the plant access to a lot of water and nutrients. And so anyone that Jesus was speaking to of that time that had any experience with crops at all, they'd recognize that there are those crops that when you would pull it up and you have long, deep roots, and there are others that clearly they didn't really get rooted and they come up very quickly and they don't do too well. In the parable, the second soil is described as the rocky places where they did not have much soil. So we're to picture here ground that is hard with rocks and shallow. So it's really difficult for the roots of the plant from the seed that has been sown to actually dig in, go deep, find the nutrients and water that it needs in order to thrive. It does grow. It's not like the one that was thrown on the side of the road where it was so hard that it didn't even make it into the ground. There is a plant that starts to grow up, but it doesn't have that strong root system to nourish it, and so the plant does not have the strength to withstand the heat of the sun, and it withers away. That's how I understand what's happening in the story. Well, Jesus is saying that there is a kind of heart that is like this soil. The person responds positively to Jesus' message at first. He receives it with joy. So he hears it and says, okay, yeah, I'll go for that. Word of the kingdom, I believe that. I'll go for that. But he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary. That is, there is little in the person's heart to nourish and sustain that faith. The faith is not a reflection of a deep personal commitment to this gospel. And so a time comes when, as Jesus says, affliction or persecution arises because of the word. Now, there is a cost to being a believer. Like the sun beating down on a weak plant, the hostility of the world to the gospel basically destroys this weak, unsupported faith that the person had. It was fine when it didn't cost anything, but now that it's starting to be costly, it's not worth it to me. And so the person falls away, he says. He abandons the faith to avoid facing the hostility of the world. Well, this idea, the idea that ultimately our response to the gospel must be a strong faith that actually withstands the onslaught of the world, this is a theme that shows up a lot in Jesus' teaching. Jesus taught repeatedly that in order to find life, we must be willing to join him in standing up to the hostility and rejection of the world. This is a very strong theme in Jesus' teaching. It's not a comfortable theme, and it's somewhat difficult to sort out exactly how we should respond to it. But as I say, I think it's a big theme in his teaching, and so we're going to explore that today. This parable gives us a good beginning. We see here the gospel, the word of Jesus, is often rejected by the world. The result is that affliction or persecution comes upon those who believe that gospel. The true disciples are the ones who, as Jesus says, hear the word and understand it. They have a deep-rooted faith. They have come to understand what the gospel is and why it is significant to them. Of course, they would like to be well-treated by everyone in the world, but they want the gospel more. They can stand up to the rejection of others because they have a strong attachment to the gospel that cannot ultimately be shaken. And that's the picture that we have in this parable. Now, there are other things we could go on to say about the parable if we were to explore the parable in this context. There are things that Jesus is wanting to say about the nature of being a citizen in the kingdom of God and so on, but I'm going to leave it at that for now. We're going to just concentrate on that one of the soils because, as I say, that's the theme we want to look at today. So Jesus talks about this idea in a number of places. Let's look at another one. This should be familiar. I talked about this one not too long ago. This is from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. And I want to look at verse 10 of Matthew 5. In verse 10, at the end of what we call the Beatitudes, Jesus says this, starting in verse 10 of Matthew 5. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, before I forget, I make a comment. That last statement about men seeing your works and glorifying your Father in heaven, that's another aspect of things, that there is at times the positive response to the living out of faith in the world. That's not our topic today, so we're not going to talk a lot about that one. We're talking about the hard part. So it was only last summer that we went through the Sermon on the Mount, so today we'll just review the main points in this section to reinforce our picture of this theme in Jesus' teaching. Let me remind you that, as I understand it, the Beatitudes are a series of statements, first of all, that have this form, blessed are those who are X, for they have a great destiny. And I would paraphrase the basic structure of each of the Beatitudes as something like this. Although it may seem strange to say, those who are X are the truly fortunate ones because only they will have a great destiny in the kingdom of God. That's what I would understand the Beatitudes basically to be doing, and that's exactly what we see Jesus doing when he talks about persecution in verse 10. You wouldn't think that being persecuted would make you a fortunate person, a blessed person. But in fact, the kingdom of heaven belongs to those who are persecuted in this way. Okay, so what kind of persecution are we talking about? Persecuted for what reason? Jesus describes it here in two ways. Persecuted for the sake of righteousness, persecuted on account of Jesus. That is, persecuted because we are disciples and followers of Jesus. The world has a certain hostility to the teachings of Jesus and the kind of righteousness that he has called us to. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Why would Jesus say that we are blessed, fortunate, to be persecuted in this way? Well, he says the kingdom of heaven is the destiny of those who are persecuted for following him. Their reward in heaven is great. And he urges us to think about the prophets. If there's anyone who's going to find a place in the kingdom of heaven, it's the prophets, right? I mean, these are God's guys. God likes the prophets. They faithfully proclaimed the message of God. They took a stand for God and for his righteousness. And look how it turned out for them. The world didn't like them. It rejected their message. It persecuted them. Sometimes it killed them. So this gives us something to think about. If you want a prophet's reward, you have to accept the prophet's lack of popularity. The fact is that standing for God can make you unpopular in the world. And Jesus is saying, so wouldn't you ultimately like to be in God's good graces the way the prophets were? Well, unfortunately, if you're going to do that, the world may not care for you. And let's just notice at this point that Jesus is explaining why we should welcome persecution, because those who are persecuted for following him have a great destiny. He uses this language, reward in heaven, and I would like to talk more about that in a little bit. But at least we can see that he is suggesting that the outcome is good for the one who is persecuted in this way, and that's why that person is fortunate. He also is implying that it's really going to be inevitable that somewhere along the line something like this is going to happen. If we're going to follow him and find a home in the kingdom of God, then there are going to be those that are not going to like it. If we are unwilling to be unpopular, then we are unwilling to follow Jesus. In Luke's version of the Beatitudes, we see Jesus giving the flip side of this beatitude. Here he says, blessed are you when you are persecuted. In Luke, he adds the flip side, woe to you when all men speak well of you. For in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets. If everybody thinks you are cool, you have to wonder whether your life stands for anything in particular. If you haven't managed to get anybody offended by what you think and stand for, you have to wonder, where am I coming from ultimately? It is this inevitability that Jesus highlights in the three famous analogies that follow the beatitude itself. We have the city set on a hill, which cannot be hidden. We have the salt that is not salty, is worthless, and we don't light a lamp to hide it under a bushel. Each of these little pictures is basically dashing our secret hope that we could just blend in and not cause any fuss. We would like to follow Jesus and still be like everyone else so we don't get in trouble. But if you follow Jesus, you are like a city set on a hill. You stick out from everything around you. It's just the nature of things. You're like salt in food. The whole point is that the salt is noticeably salty. If it isn't salty, then you throw it out. You are like a lamp that has been lit at nighttime. The whole point is that the light is noticeably bright, that it shines in the dark and shines light on what's in the rest of what's in the room. So these pictures all have that same idea, that there is this noticeability about following Jesus. You're going to be different, and that difference is going to be noticed. We must accept and embrace the fact that as followers of Jesus, we are different and we will be noticed as being different. Even if it means being rejected by the world, we must embrace that difference. Jesus is taking us a different way. If others reject us for leaving the path they are on, well, so be it. It has to be that way. Jesus is calling us to be different than the world around us. I think that's clearly what he's saying. Let me take us to look at one more passage where Jesus explores this theme. This is perhaps the most sobering of all of them, although they're all somewhat sobering. This is going to be now in the passage we looked at last week, a different part of it. We're going to Matthew 10. While you're turning there, let me just remind you that this passage is in the same context as a passage that we looked at last week. Jesus is sending his disciples out to minister in his name. And he's talking to them about the reception they will receive. Last week, we looked at verse 40, where he said, "He who receives you receives me." He was talking about a positive reception, that someone might actually welcome me and my message, Jesus was saying, and therefore he would welcome you, my disciple. Now we're looking at the flip side of that. Here the reaction that we're getting is not so positive. And this is just before the passage that verse 40. We're going to look at Matthew 10, 32 through 39. "Everyone, therefore, who shall confess me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever shall deny me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life shall lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake shall find it." Okay, as I say, this is the rejection half of the picture in Jesus talking to his disciples about the kind of reaction that they might get. "Many will not receive you," he's saying, "and it is because you follow me and are representing me that they will not receive you." So, how are you going to respond to that? First, he confronts them with this very stark choice in language that has to be unsettling to us if we're paying attention at all. I mean, if you can hear this sort of thing and not be a little bit concerned, I think you haven't been paying attention to your own life. At least, let me speak for myself. I get nervous when I read stuff like this. Basically, he's saying, confronting us with this choice, if we deny him before men, he will deny us before the Father. If I want Jesus to be on my side, I have to be willing to be on his side, whatever that might cost me. If Frank is willing to say, "I'm with Jesus," then Jesus will say, "I'm with Frank," on the day of judgment. But if Frank is unwilling to side with Jesus because of what people might do to him, Jesus will be unwilling to side with Frank. Very clear-cut, very stark. I have to decide whose opinion of me matters the most, Jesus or the rest of the world. Jesus then again goes on to highlight the inevitability of this conflict, and he does it by talking about the very result of his own ministry. He says that he didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. He knows it. My coming has confronted human beings with a choice that will divide them. Some will choose to follow me, others will not, and that will be a fundamental and a divisive issue between people. It's such a fundamental choice that often there is no way to reconcile those who follow Jesus with those who reject him, and ultimately there is no way. The divisions will even reach into families, people who normally would have a close bond of kinship. Family ties are not strong enough to hold together people who have made different choices about God. And so, again, we must decide how important Jesus is to us. He who loves father or mother more than Jesus is not worthy of him. And hopefully in the context you can see what he's saying. He's not, I think many of us would find that being in the presence of our parents that we care about evokes stronger emotions than I might feel thinking about Jesus whom I have never met. I mean, that sort of, I'm here with you and I'm feeling very warmly toward you, that's not the kind of thing that we're talking about here. When he talks about loving them more than me, he's asking them, whose opinion do you care about? Who does it matter more to you is on your side? Who do you want on your team more? You want your parents on your team or you want me on your team? Because there may come that place where you have to choose. And that's what he's talking about. Sometimes that we see the language about, you know, you have to hate your father and mother and think that somehow Jesus is suggesting something unnatural, that somehow we are to put aside the natural bonds of family kinship and say, you don't mean anything to me anymore. That's ridiculous. That's not at all what he's getting at. But he is saying, if it comes to that place where my family is going that way and Jesus is going that way, then I'm going to have to decide who I'm going with. Jesus then uses this very famous language that we must take up our cross and follow him. There are several ways I've heard this language interpreted in the past. You're probably familiar with the general idea that you need to pick up your cross is often used just as language to describe pretty much any sort of sacrifice that I might need to make in my pursuit of the gospel in following Jesus. We must be willing to give up things and sacrifice our own comforts and so on. That is absolutely true. I don't think that's the focus of the statement, but of course it's true. I mean, I am called to follow Jesus whatever it might cost me in any arena. I mean, there isn't anything more valuable than obeying God and finding life through his mercy. So, I mean, everything's on the table. But I think in this case, this language of picking up your cross, carrying your cross, is meant to be more specific. The context, as we've been talking about, is being willing to endure the rejection of men that comes from following Jesus. If I follow Jesus, I may be rejected by those who do not follow him. Now, remember, at this time, the people that Jesus is talking to, they don't know that Jesus is going to die on the cross, but what do they know about the cross? They know the cross is an instrument of execution. You really can't commit suicide by putting yourself on a cross. I mean, somebody else has to do it to you. Somebody has to want you dead and wants to hang you up there. It's as if Jesus had said, walk up and put your head in the hangman's noose, or sit down in the electric chair, or stand in front of the firing squad. I mean, this is language that is speaking to the ultimate rejection, that the government or whoever has looked at your life and said, it is no longer wanted and you're going to be executed. So I really think that we need to see this idea of carrying your cross in this context as being focused on the idea that I am willing to embrace the rejection of the world, even to the point of death. So I think this is what Jesus is saying. Every day we are to follow Jesus, well aware that the world rejected him, and willing to face that rejection ourselves, even to the point of death. I think that's what he's saying in that section. And then when he goes on to talk about this choice, about whether I'm going to find my life or lose it, he means in this world, am I going to hang on to my life and what I have in this world so that I don't lose anything now? He says, if you do that, then ultimately you're going to lose your life. But if you're willing to let go of it, then you will gain it. It is the one who is willing in following Jesus to let go of whatever he might lose in following Jesus, that's the one who's ultimately going to gain. And we really are talking about, in this context, the kind of loss and gain that comes through following Jesus and the rejection of the world that can come from that. So those are the three passages I want to look at. I think the idea is fairly clear, But it raises a lot of questions, I think, for us as to how exactly we should understand the implications of this. There are several things that seem to me that are worth talking about. So what I'm going to try to do is talk about some of these issues and tell you what makes sense to me about the implications of this and what we're going to do with it. So first of all, let's note, I hope it's been clear, that Jesus is telling us that to follow him means paying a particular kind of cost. This is what he's focusing on here. There can be a cost in following him. And in particular, he's talking about the fact that the world rejected him. By following him, we will face the possibility that the world will reject us as well. If the world doesn't like what he's about, and we're about what he's about, then it's not going to like what we're about. And in fact, that rejection could cost us our very lives. It might cost us everything that we have in this world. Now, for Jesus, this was not an exaggeration. This is not hyperbole in his language, because remember, he himself was executed. A number of his apostles, the men he chose to teach others his message, they also were executed. Throughout the centuries, many Christians have paid with their lives precisely because they are Christians, and that continues to this very day. It still happens in our world today. So the idea that one might lose one's life for following Jesus is not just an exaggerated statement to make a point. It is very real possibility. And in Jesus' context, it was even a likely possibility. In following Jesus, we risk being treated the way Jesus was treated. And that could mean anything from mild disapproval to murderous hostility. And I think he means the whole spectrum. That's what we might face. So, if this is true then, first of all, let's talk about why does Jesus think we should be willing to take such a risk? Why would he use language like you're blessed when you're persecuted? Does he keep tying our willingness to face these things with our ultimate destiny? And why should we be willing to face these things? Well, it seems to me, as we look at his overall teaching, that there are at least two answers that we could find, and maybe more. What struck me as I thought about what is it that he's saying to us about why should I be willing to embrace this suffering, two things struck me. First of all, following him and submitting to the will of God is the right thing to do. And following him and submitting to the will of God is the most beneficial thing to do. Now, obviously, first of all, everything about Jesus' teaching shouts out that following God is the right thing to do. It is morally necessary for us submit ourselves to the will of God. God is our creator. God is the one who sets the standard for how life is to be lived. He has made the world to be a certain way, and it is my task to fit into that world as he wishes me to. And Jesus was sent by God to fulfill God's purposes in the world. So there is no justification for turning away from God. There's no situation in which I can say, in this case, I'm right to ignore God and go my own way. No matter what the world may think of me, I must do what is right and follow God. So that would be one reason that Jesus would give, that I ought to face the hostility of the world, because whether the world likes me or not, the only right thing for me to do is to follow God and trust Jesus. But notice that in the passages we looked at today, the emphasis is on the positive outcome for ourselves. Ours is the kingdom of heaven. Our reward in heaven is great. Jesus will confess us before the Father. Now, we have not yet in this series talked much about the idea of the kingdom of heaven. And that is still to come. I know that we have not talked much about that. It's hard to talk about the themes in Jesus' teaching without talking about the concept of the kingdom of heaven. I'm putting that one off because it's probably one of the hardest talks I have to give in this series, and I'm desperately hoping that something some miracle happens and I'm able to perform my task when it comes around. It's not that I have nothing to say, but it's a complex topic. But let me just say here, in this context, probably it's been apparent from my comments, but when Jesus talks about the ours is the kingdom of heaven, I believe him to be talking about something in the future. He is talking about the next age. He is talking about eternal life. He is talking about being rescued from death and God's judgment to live forever under the rule of Christ in God's kingdom. That's the sort of thing that he's talking about. There are those who would disagree about that, but that's where I'm coming from right now. And that's what he's getting at when he says our reward in heaven is great. There is this future result that we are looking for. It is that future glorious outcome that makes it blessed to be persecuted now, is what he's saying. That you want that outcome. You don't want to miss out on being a citizen in the kingdom of God. So whatever it would take to get there, that's what you ought to willingly embrace, because there isn't any better deal around. So let me just say a word about that phrase, your reward in heaven. The English word reward can suggest to us that we are doing something for God. We show how great we are by living a godly life, and so God rewards us. You know, good job, here's your reward. But Jesus teaches, and I firmly believe, that our salvation is a work of God. God reaches out to us. God opens our eyes. God perfects our faith through his Spirit. Our salvation is God's work, not ours. It was God's decision to be merciful. It was not me that convinced him to be merciful through what a good guy I am. So it's not reward in the sense of, good job, I like what you did better, so I'm going to give you a reward. But we do follow Christ with the hope of a desirable outcome. We have been promised life, and we are looking for that life. Our hope is that when we trust in Christ, God will mercifully bless us and grant us eternal life. That is the reward that we're looking for. Maybe a better idea would be the desired outcome. I am doing this in the hope that it will result in this good thing. I'm not earning my salvation through good works. I am trusting the promises of God that he will be merciful to me if I turn to him and look for that mercy. We are living the lives of believers who need God's mercy, and in the end we are rewarded with the life that he has promised. That is the desirable outcome, the very thing that he has promised and we are looking for. That is what we receive. So I think that's what the language of reward there is talking about. It's not talking about rewards in heaven, like if you do good deeds, then you get to live in a better house than I will, you know, and your mansion will have more rooms or that kind of thing. It's we're talking just fundamentally about there is this desirable outcome that we are looking for, and you want to be one who has a reward in heaven. If you don't have a reward in heaven, then you have lost. So I do think that Jesus is urging us to be motivated by our ultimate destiny. If men are hostile to us, the most they can do is kill us, as Jesus puts it. But it is God who controls my eternal destiny. If God is on my side, then I'm going to be okay. And if I have turned away from God and God is not on my side, then I will be lost. Doesn't matter what other people think about me. It only matters what God thinks about me. So the fact that God is the one who has my eternal destiny in his hand is very much what Jesus is saying as a crucial part of my motivation as I think about who am I afraid of? Who is it that is going to determine how I choose to do things? Am I going to choose to live in a certain way because I'm afraid of what people can do to me? Or am I going to live in a certain way because I recognize that God is the one whose determination is ultimately the most important? Okay, so that the positive incentive then for facing up to the rejection of the world is, it is the right thing to do, and it is the best thing for myself that I can do. Now, let's think a little bit about the nature of this hostility between Jesus and the world. And I think the place to start, at least for me, as I think about this, is the context of Jesus' own life and what he experienced and what his immediate followers, the apostles, experienced. In Jesus' own life and context, the strongest opposition to him came from religious people. It was the religious leaders of the Jews who had Jesus executed. It was the religious leaders who first persecuted his followers. Granted, the Gentile rulers came along and did a good job later on, but at first, it was the religious leaders among the Jews who were the biggest opponents of the followers of Jesus. Why did they reject Jesus and thus his followers? Well, I've pulled out from my memory certain things that I have seen in the Gospels that show us the way that Jesus interacted with those religious leaders and what they didn't like about him. First of all, he violated their emphasis on the keeping of religious ritual by doing things like healing on the Sabbath. He accused them of loving money too much. He accused them of using religion as a means of gaining the approval of the crowd. He accused them of violating the heart and soul of the law while they portrayed themselves as lawkeepers. He accused them of being unwilling to confess the true extent of their own evil and repent of it. He accused them of being unmerciful. And while he was at it, he said they didn't know God, they didn't love God, and they were children of the devil. So he didn't say a lot to them that you know, won him friends or influenced people in that regard. But in other words, these religious people were accused by Jesus of having the same fundamentally worldly motives that the pagans and unbelievers around them had. They, in their own minds, had set themselves apart as, we're the ones who are following God, we're the ones who are different from the world around us. But Jesus was basically saying, you're no different. They wanted what they wanted, and they did not want God to come along telling them that they were in the wrong. As Jesus put it, just before he went to Jerusalem and soon after was executed, the world hates me because I testify to it that its deeds are evil. So, as followers of Jesus, one of the things that is going to happen through us is that we will be a constant reminder that God is calling the world to repent. And we don't have to stand on the street corner with a sign that says repent. Just by the very fact of our being people who are committed to the gospel means that the message of repent is implicit in the stance that we are taking toward life. And the world around us is not going to like it. Okay, now this gets to the really hard part. And I'm just trying to think this through and tell you how I think about it. I recognize I'm not the last word on this topic, but I'm very aware that this kind of language can sound, as I'm describing it, it can sound very clean and abstract. Yeah, hey, okay, got it. Yeah, we're the good guys, we're on God's side, and the bad guys in the world don't like us and they're going to beat us up. Well, it's complicated. I mean, if you look at the world that we live in, it's not so clean and simple sometimes. This may seem like a strange and somewhat simplistic way of looking at the world sometimes. Maybe you have thought this through and it doesn't seem that way to you, but I think at times we do wrestle with this theme in Jesus' teaching. Is it true? I mean, is the world, we're the brave, dedicated, virtuous Christians being fed to the lions in the Colosseum all day long? Is this the reality that we experience? We know that happened in history somewhere along the line, but heck, that was the Romans. I mean, they were tough. I mean, but we've come a long way since then, right? Well, first of all, of course, we all know that in parts of the world it is true. I mean, that's literally true. People are being executed because they are followers of Christ. But we can't help thinking about our own situation. What does this say about me? What is Jesus saying to me about how I ought to live and how I ought to respond to the world that I live in? Most of our non-Christian neighbors probably don't give us much of a hard time. And a lot of the flack that Christians get in this world seems to have been brought on by themselves. I mean, you look at the opinion that a lot of people have of things that Christians do, and it's hard not to kind of share that opinion sometimes. You know, it doesn't look that good sometimes what's happening out there. So how is it that we're going to take Jesus' teaching to heart on this? What does this mean to us, really? And I just have a few thoughts. Many more thoughts than these would be necessary and deserving, but this is what I got for now. First of all, we want to be clear about what Jesus is saying to us here. Jesus is not calling us to go out and make enemies. And he's not saying, you know, you can measure how good a disciple you are by how many people you have ticked off in the last week or something like that. He is calling us to obediently follow the rest of his teaching, to embrace his vision of life and to make it a part of our life and to put our hope where he says our hope should rest, in the promises of God. That's what we're called to do. So maybe right now that isn't costing us much in the world. Maybe most people are not particularly ticked off with us for having made that decision. Okay, great. You know, rejoice, be happy. That's great. But our task is not to try to measure how many enemies we have or to stir up more enemies or something like that. Our task is to be faithful to the gospel. And I think soon enough you're going to find that the people around you are going to have a problem with you if that's in fact what your life is about. Somewhere along the line that's going to happen. Next, I agree, and we need to recognize that a lot of so-called Christians in the world are making themselves unloved because they do not, in fact, love their enemies. They give lip service to the idea of loving their enemies, but they don't really. And the world catches the whiff of the Pharisees on them. Because remember, I mean, the Pharisees, a Pharisee can get persecuted too. I mean, and Pharisee can go home rejoicing, saying, boy, I'm so faithful, everybody hates me. It's not just the believers that get persecuted. It's the self-righteous Pharisees who also are hated by everyone. So sometimes what happens in the world is that, as Jesus warned us, that a genuine, humble faith has been replaced by a sort of self-righteous satisfaction that I'm a religious person who's better than everybody else, and the world catches that whiff of self-righteousness, and they are rightly repelled by it. So, I mean, the only answer that we can give to that is in ourselves to not go that way, to not be that sort of person. We are called to be faithful and not to flaunt our so-called superiority to others. So that's our call, to faithfully and humbly be followers of Christ who, as to the extent that we can, we try not to communicate to other people that we somehow feel like the reason that we're going to heaven and they're not is that God recognized how much better we are than the other person. On the other hand, we need to guard against the opposite temptation, and I think this is probably more of a temptation for us. Well, what am I saying there? Maybe that's not the way to put it. Religious self-righteousness is definitely a temptation in the world. But if you stay away from that, you can end up on the other side, which can be problematic as well. And what I'm talking about here is that desire somehow, that sense that it is my obligation to make everybody happy, that I'm going to be the sort of person that nobody could disapprove of. I think some of us would like to believe, and when I say that, I'm not pointing the finger, because this is a very strong tendency in myself. I am talking about myself here, and I'm talking probably about others of you too, but that's just because my aim isn't very good. I'm shooting at myself and I hit you at the same time. But this is a temptation that I understand very well. We would like to believe that if we are just personally nice enough, no one will ever be offended by us. In fact, if anyone ever is offended by us, we feel that this in itself is evidence that we're doing something wrong. If I were doing it right, then people would not be offended with me. And so we will perhaps back off and try to be even nicer. Well, if Jesus is saying anything in the things that we looked at here today, he is saying that there is a dividing line. This choice about whether to follow God or not is an alienating choice. That those who will not follow God have cut themselves off from, in a very real way, from those who have chosen to follow God. There are people that can be so hostile to God that they will never reconcile themselves to God's people, no matter how hard we try. Remember, he said that he came to bring not peace, but a sword. And that's like, for me, Jesus saying, I came not to bring peace, but a sword, has to be like at times, you know, one of my life verses to remind me that he didn't come to make everybody happy with each other. Because I really want everybody to be happy with each other. I really do. I'm being sincere here. I don't want anybody unhappy with me. So it's bracing to be reminded, you know, actually I came into the world to divide people, in a sense. I mean, not to bring hatred, but I'm confronting people with a choice that is going to set people against each other, because that choice is a fundamental and ultimate one. If we set the goal to be pleasing to everyone, we will either be disappointed or else we will be faithless to God. Ultimately, we have to remind ourselves that there are these, you know, it's the old picture. You don't want to fall off on either side of the horse, right? You don't want to, on the one side, be self-righteous, condemning, unaccepting, unloving to those who are unbelievers, and yet at the same time, we don't want to end up seeing it as our task to be loved by everyone. We need to be willing to embrace the idea that to go the right way sometimes means it makes life harder. It's also helpful to remember that the world can show its rejection in a lot of different ways, and I'm no expert on this stuff, but let's just think about how that happens. It occurs to me that in spite of America's reputation, we do live in one of the less violent cultures in the world. You wouldn't think so watching our movies. But the fact is that Americans don't tend to drag their religious opponents into the street and stone them to death. And we benefit from that, because very few people are dragging us into the streets and stoning us to death. But, so we think, okay, so we look at Jesus on the cross and the Christians before the lions and the Colosseum and all that and say, well, that's not me. But those same Americans who will not drag us into the street and stone us may cut Christians out of their lives in subtle ways. They can refuse to hire Christians as professors because they believe the book of Genesis. They can refuse to let Christians adopt because Christians are fundamentalists. They can call Christians oppressors of women because they speak out against abortion. They can just subtly hint that Christians will not be accepted into polite company until they abandon their inappropriate beliefs. And I think many of us have experienced those kinds of pressures, just that sense that to be publicly Christian in certain environments is to make everybody uncomfortable. You're one of those. And I'm remembering back when Linda Ronstadt made the comment that sometimes she thinks about if there are any, I forget how she put it, fundamentalist Christians or something like that in the audience at her shows, it makes her uncomfortable. You know, it's just that sort of thing. You know, polite society doesn't like those kind of people. You know, we find a way of pushing them out. And as each of these kinds of rejection tempts us as Christians to compromise, to let go of Jesus so that we can keep our family, friends, and neighbors happy, we face this choice. What are we going to do? Who are we going to keep happy in the end? So, I don't know. I mean, I'd welcome your own thoughts on what this looks like. I mean, there are these two things. We may not recognize the reality of what certain kinds of rejection and persecution might look like in the world. And on the other hand, we can be overly touchy and be ready to see persecution where it doesn't exist. I mean, it needs wisdom. It needs judgment to understand this. But the key is that what Jesus is calling us to is to embrace his gospel for ourselves, to not be afraid to be known to be embracing his gospel for ourselves, and let the chips fall where they will in the world. Okay, my last comment here then is that this is another great example, I think, of how Jesus teaches that our faith will be tested as we live out our lives being a believer in the world. The world is going to push on us in certain ways, calling on us to actually live out the implications of our faith, forcing us to mature and grow up in our faith as we face these choices. Many of you here know where I'm going to go with this, because I probably mentioned this in most of the times I teach anywhere, but that's all right. It's good stuff. I love to think about the actually tragic and sad and incredibly terrible day in the life of Peter when he denied Jesus three times. When Jesus was arrested, you probably know, Peter freaked out and denied that he even knew Jesus. He did it on three separate occasions. He did it, and then he had the chance to think about it, and he did it again, and he had the chance to think about it, and he did it again. Only after that, when the cock crows, as Jesus predicted, and he remembers that Jesus had predicted he would do that, he breaks down in weeping over what he had done. Okay, so as tragic as that is, and as much as I really identify and feel for Peter in that situation, I think it's a tremendous kindness of God that he gave us that picture as we try to sort all of this stuff out. Because Jesus said that if you deny me before men, I will deny you before the Father. Well, I mean, Peter denied Jesus before men three separate times. He had a chance to think about it even, and then he did it again, and then he did it again. So, and yet, I think it's obvious as we look at Peter's role, Peter, you know, his letters made it into the New Testament, what Jesus said to him after when he was resurrected and all of that, it is clear that Jesus is not going to deny Peter before the Father. That's just not going to happen. So how then do I understand Jesus' teaching? Did he not mean it? Is he saying, well, if you're an apostle, you get a free pass? Or what, how do you put those things together? Well, this is how I would put it together. I think you have to understand the way Jesus teaches on these topics. He speaks in categorical terms. If you deny me, I will deny you. If you do not forgive, you will not be forgiven. And he means what he's saying in those cases, but he doesn't mean it as a set of rules that he is laying down. Look, here are the rules. If you violate any of them, you're out. I think instead he is describing to us the ways in which the world is going to push on our faith and the way that we ultimately must respond to it. What does my faith mean to me in the kinds of situations that Jesus has been describing as we've been going through? When people reject me for my faith, or when I must decide how to treat my neighbor, or when people sin against me, or when I must deal with other believers. What does the fact that I believe in Jesus mean when the rubber meets the road and I'm dealing with those real life situations? In the midst of these trials of my faith, the things that ultimately show what I'm about, but also are very difficult situations to go through, I will struggle and sometimes I will fail. That's one of the great mercies of the picture of Jesus saying, if you deny me, I will deny you. And then we see his foremost apostle, the one who he said, on this rock I will build my church, and all of that. He, the greatest of the apostles, is the one who denies him. It just tells me that this is a complicated struggle that we're talking about. It's not a one strike and you're out kind of deal. We're talking about the emergence and growth of the reality of my faith and commitment to God in a very imperfect world, sinner that I am, as the pressures of life come at me. The assurance really in all of this is that ultimately the work of God will prevail in my life. So when we face the hostility of the world, then, in whatever form it may take, we are confronted with these big questions. Is this faith really worth it to me? Do I think it's true enough that I would actually invest my life in it and face the hostility that is coming my way? Is God really there and really to be trusted? Do I really believe that this Jesus will bring me the life that he promised? Do I even want that life? I mean, maybe there's other stuff that I want more. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff in the world. Eternal life is very abstract and distant. So does it really mean so much to me that I am willing right now, here and now, to face this sort of thing? I think Jesus would say that ultimately, if we are unwilling to face the world's hostility, not just the failure of nerve that happened to Peter, not that struggle with one's own sin and fear that leads to very messy results in the midst of this, but ultimately, if my heart is set against, I will not pay the price. I will not lose my place in this world due to the hostility that the world feels toward Jesus. If that's my stance, then I have really turned away from Jesus and the promises that he offers. Ultimately, the world is going one way and Jesus is going another. And however much we might think we can, it is impossible to walk down two roads at the same time. Ultimately, we have to decide which road we're going down. Okay, well, that's the danger of giving me a lot of time. You guys should have said more at the beginning because I just went on and on. So, and there's still time for questions, see? This was a tactical mistake on your part. The mic is coming.
I feel nervous.
That's okay, don't worry.
I sometimes feel like my questions are rather naive, but I'm going to ask anyway. I was confronted with a situation today with a friend whose young daughter is being bullied because she is in a Christian environment, and her mother made her make a choice about a friend. And the mother of the friend, who is worldly, I guess you would say, her response was, I wish you would, all those kids, I wish they'd just get along. But what is going on is way more than that. It's vicious and mean-spirited. My question is, when, as a parent or as the friend to the parent, we want to protect our children. So my question is, how do you just take something like that day by day? Obviously, you have to trust in God. But how do you deal with that?
I don't think that your question can be categorized as naive when I am at a loss to know how to answer it. That's a really hard situation from my perspective. Bringing children into it, this is kind of my stock answer when it comes to thinking about children is, I think about us as parents as there is this sort of shift of responsibility that when the child first is born, I am totally responsible for taking care of them and protecting them from everything. And as they get older, bit by bit, I am letting more and more responsibility for their own welfare and so forth into their own hands, the choices they make about how they're going to live their lives and conduct themselves, with the goal that ultimately they will have arrived at the place where they are mature adults who can choose for themselves and hopefully choose the right way, although I can't ultimately determine that. So what complicates that picture for me is, yes, on the one hand, I mean, and you tell me if I may be even missing your question here, but on the one hand, I want to encourage my children to get along with others. I want to encourage them to stand up for what they believe and not not back down from what they believe just because someone else disapproves of it. But as I say, that's all complicated by that. Where is this child? And how much do they understand? How much are they able to take care of? How much emotional weight are they able to carry at this point in their lives and all of that? And I don't know one particular right answer to that, I guess, is I would be trying to use my judgment as to where is my kid in their particular journey so that I can decide how much am I going to encourage them to take this on themselves, how much am I going to protect them from, and so forth. And I don't know, that's probably not a very good answer, but that's how it... Does that speak to the issue that you're raising?
Yes.
Okay.
It does.
Okay, good. Well, that's good.
There's an author named Paul Coughlin that has written on the subject of bullying. I like a lot of his ideas. I think he would be a worthwhile person to go to for some basic thinking on this topic.
Bill, how's that spelled?
Coughlin.
Okay. That's good. Good.
I have a question about the soils, the parable, and the ultimate outcome, which was the fruitfulness. And I would appreciate your using up some of that time talking about what our lives are going to look like if they're fruitful.
Well, let's see what's some of the evidence that we have in trying to put that together. One thing that people often point to is the fact that twice he emphasizes the fact that the good soil, the seed falls on it, and there is fruit that comes from it, but it's different in different cases. What does he say? Some 100, some 60, some 30, or something like that. So it seems as if he does seem to want to build into his story this idea that there is definitely a result. There is definitely the fruit that the sower was looking for in sowing the seed to begin with, but it can be variable because he puts that in the story itself, but then when he explains the story, he repeats that part. So it seems as if he means that to be a part of the thing. So that's one thing I would look at. The thing that he's talking about seems to be something that must necessarily be there, but it can vary in the lives of the individuals who have responded positively to the gospel. The fruit that emerges can be, in some cases, kind of more overwhelmingly obvious than in other cases or something like that. I'm inclined to think that with the way he described it, he says the last soil, the soil, that's the heart that has understood the gospel, he says, that understood the word of the kingdom. And it's deep-rooted. It is a fundamental part of that person's heart, such that their heart nourishes that faith, even in the face of opposition. It is strong enough that it is not overwhelmed by the attractions of the world, such that the seductions of this world choke it out. But instead, there is understanding and a deep embracing of this gospel. So I would see the fruit that we're talking about as being essentially the effect of the gospel in the lives of Jesus' people as reflected in his teaching about what that would look like. So the Sermon on the Mount is filled with these pictures of what it looks like. The Beatitudes are talking about, you know, mourning and being humble and hungering and thirsting for righteousness. And so the impact of the gospel in shaping me as a person who is being molded by the truths of the gospel, and that is showing itself in my life, that will happen for everyone, but it's various. I mean, the circumstances of our lives, how long I've been a believer, the things that God takes me through, the personal challenges and struggles that I may have, whereas one thing would be easy for most people to deal with, this is hard for me to deal with because of the kind of person I am, and so forth. All of that can affect, as I look out, what does it look like? How much is the gospel bearing fruit in someone's life? In wisdom, in a life lived with understanding and mature wisdom about what the gospel means in life. But everyone will have some. Everyone will have some measure of wisdom. Starting with, you know, God is there, I'm counting on him, I really need his mercy, and going from there. So that's how I would picture, I don't know if that's clear, but that's how I would picture that. The fruit is not how many people I convert, and the fruit is not, I wouldn't say, this is that place where I always want to make this distinction, it's not how great and wonderful and righteous and perfect you are. We're talking about something else. I mean, part of the fruit would be a deep, deep confession of the reality of my own sin. Well, you can't be looking and saying, I'm well aware of the many ways in which I am not what I ought to be, and being showing off how perfect you are at the same time, because you're showing off how perfect you are not. I mean, that's part of it. But that's fruit. That humility and acknowledgement of my own sin is part of the fruit, the wisdom that emerges from the gospel. A person who is forgiving of others, the things that we have been looking at. A person who is coming to understand that other people are as important as they are. A person who recognizes in fellow believers those who share this destiny with me, and thus they are really my family in a sense. All of those things, as those things emerge, that's how I would picture the fruit that he's talking about. Because when it comes to ultimately the salvation that will be ours, I don't think that's the kind of crop that he's talking about, because there isn't a variation there. We all end up with the cup overflowing in the end. But when we look at this life and the results in this life of being a disciple of Jesus, yeah, there are some who have the opportunity to grow into more maturity and wisdom about the faith and the way they live than others do. But all of us do some. That's what I'd say.
A quick follow-up. The fruit of the Spirit, I don't mean to take up a lot of time, but just, is that just the natural outflow of the maturing, the wisdom that God's Spirit produces in us as we respond to the truths? And
Right. So if you go and look at the fruits of the Spirit, I've done this in the past. I can't summon it to mind right at the moment, but if you go and look at each of the fruits of the Spirit and then go look in Paul's letters and in Jesus' teaching and stuff, especially if you look in Paul's letters because he's the one that made the list of the fruit of the Spirit, if you go and look at the way he talks about those things, you can often find him explicitly saying that it is because we believe the gospel and have firmly committed ourselves to believing that gospel that these qualities are emerging. So I'd say that it's clear that he's not just saying the Spirit just sort of magically fills you with joy or something like that, but that you know, as he says in Romans 15, his prayer that God would fill us with joy in believing. That is, that our faith would be strengthened, we would believe the promises of the gospel more fully, and thus there would be a kind of spiritual Christian joy that results from that, the satisfaction, yes, this is what I want, this is what I'm hoping for, this is what I'm looking for. So I think the qualities there, yeah, are not, here the Spirit is going to come along and make it so that you don't have any moral problems anymore, you're just perfectly loving and joyous and self-controlled and all of that. It is rather the emerging of these qualities out of the fact that, just the sort of thing I was talking about, that wisdom is becoming mine because I am more and more truly embracing in my life the gospel and its implications. So yeah, fruit of the Spirit and the fruit that he's talking about here, I actually don't have any problem with saying that in a sense they're kind of the same thing.
I just wanted to comment. It's almost 10 years since I have been part of this fellowship, and I just appreciate so much the depth of teaching and the clarity about what it really means to be a believer. I grew up with this parable and the story of the vine and the branches. The teaching was, well, yes, if you once, you know, accepted the Lord, then you are saved. But, you know, maybe you won't bear fruit, but,
right. You
know, you're saved. And I just appreciate so much the truth that is taught here.
Great. Well, yeah, I mean, if I can say this without sounding like I'm congratulating myself, so do I. But, and I say it in all sincerity, what I just said about that parable, I think, is closer to what Jesus is getting at than that kind of teaching that I heard that too. And I think ultimately it's better for us to be clearer about what Jesus is saying. So yeah, that's good. I agree. I need to pay close attention to what I'm saying, because sometimes it's okay. Okay, well, maybe we'll stop at that. Thanks. We'll, God willing, we'll be at it again next week.